This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 10104. Lecture 25, delivered on the 20th of November of 2008. The title of this lecture is Forward Contracts and Auctions.
Today, forward contracts and auctions. I'll address the latter subject first here, auctions. A long time ago in America, many people would have been familiar with open auctions. It was part of Americana, especially in small town and rural America. Well, old man Creedy died, so there's going to be an estate auction at his farm. And there would be a gathering. It would be an event. People from town, people from the countryside would come in and pull up in their old jalopies and their cars, and they would bid at the auction, or maybe even just sit around, look around at things, see that there wasn't anything they wanted, but it was still quite an event. My father was an auctioneer in that time, and I saw him in my young years doing the old auction routine with that very fast, and I guess maybe he thought maybe I could learn it, but I never did quite get the hang of it until much later in my life. Turned out it was inherited, but I just didn't figure it out until later. But that was a part of Americana, and young people were exposed to this. If you were a kid, you knew what an auction was. You might have seen one. But then that kind of disappeared from the American scene, especially as people moved into larger towns and cities. They didn't see the auctions. They might have had some sense of them from a few movies and from television shows where they saw auctions for art or something like that, but they certainly didn't have too much of a sense of the thrill of an auction or the fun of an auction. And then came along services like eBay, where you were allowed to participate in a specific kind of auction. Now, do any of you actually buy things on eBay or bid on eBay? Now, as I have told you, I am an eBay ho. I am on eBay every night trying to buy stuff. It is fun to go on there. And oftentimes I get furious because these idiots just troll eBay waiting for the last second to jump your bid. However, I will take them out. I will beat them. But there are some times when you don't want to. If you're not familiar with the way eBay works, it's a classic kind of auction, a type of auction, where a product is put on the auction block, and the seller starts at some bid that is his minimum that he wants the offers to come in at. And then people will say, for example, starting bid $9.99. So someone will say, $9.99 is my bid. And then someone will say, well, I'll bid more than that. Comes in $11. Someone says, well, I'll go better than that. I'll do 13. And the bidding goes up, and there's a time limit. And at the end, the auction expires, and whoever has submitted the highest bid wins the item. Unless the reserve price, if there is a reserve price set by the seller, isn't met. For example, I actually won an auction a couple of weeks ago at $45. But I didn't win the item because the reserve had been set above that price, somewhere above it. I couldn't see where it was, but apparently my winning bid was not as what the seller had wanted. He started the item at actually 99 cents, and I am guessing that he probably set the reserve at $50. My winning bid around $45, $45.02, didn't hit his reserve price. So I was upset, but that's how eBay works. Now, a couple of things before I get started on the terminology of the auctions themselves. One thing is a phenomenon in this kind of an auction called winner's curse. Winner's curse is when the winner's bid is higher than the value of the product at auction. At auction. This is a phenomenon that happens. And it is actually quite frequent. That, especially on eBay, I have seen used items go up in bidding well above the price of the product new. I just saw this last week with software, which I can buy new in the box for $150. The winning bid was $169 on it. The bidding got so furious, and the winner was actually, well, by God, I'm going to win this. I stepped back from the auction when I was getting around $140 because I thought, I can go right on a couple of software sellers and get this at a better price. But some people just kept banging it, hammering it. The bidding was furious right up to the last second. Okay, look, if this gets into back to some origins of this course. In the world of economics, and this impacts hugely in business, although no one really thinks too much about it, we assume that there is a price that reflects the value of a product. There really is a price. Now, remember when I do those supply and demand, and I, where do they cross? There's your damn price right there, right where those cross. Well, in reality, it probably wouldn't be a point in price space. It would be like a region, a small region where, you know, somewhere between, you know, $1.99 and $2.20, somewhere there, you know, We'd clear the market. The inventory on the market would be cleared by the quantity being demanded at those prices. It would be more like a range. In marketing, the obsession is to find the price point. Where is it that we can get this product sold in good numbers? And this can actually boil down in marketing, in price, in the pricing part of marketing, to pennies. Why don't you charge $2.13? Why do you charge $1.99? Well, in our culture, we read from left to right. So we'll see that the customer's going to see the dollar first, and that will be the first thing that will cause a reaction. The numbers after that will not matter as much. So if I put $2.01 on, the customer is going to react fundamentally differently from if I put $1.99 on it. In fact, it can get even more nuanced. Some sellers are absolutely convinced, don't do $1.99, do $1.97. Why? Because the seller is going to see the one, that'll favorably react, then the nine, that will be the unfavorable, but then the lucky seven, which is not really close to nine, you know, will bring the favorable reaction back. This isn't even close to $2. Okay, so it can get down to a nuance, and the nuance has more to do with psychology than it does intrinsic value. But remember, the psychology is part of the value of a product. What you think it's worth is, what the market thinks it's worth is what it is worth. So keep that in mind, that in business and in economics, we assume that there is a price out there. However, here's the thing. There is no price God who yells down, the price you will charge is $1.97. There is no one out there like that. We feel our way in the dark for the price that we should charge. And I can speak from personal experience. When I thought, wow, this is what I'll charge, I was wrong by a mile. In the Adam Smith type of world, where there are many, many buyers, many, many sellers, there is a process called price discovery, where the back and forth between the buyers and the sellers pushes the price around until the amount being delivered to the market by the sellers about matches the amount that would be wanted by the demanders in the market. So this price discovery process is a process that finds that price that we can't see with our eyes and with our minds. The market deals with it. It finds that price. It discovers it for us. And we don't get to participate in that. That's why competitive markets are so much better than monopolistic markets, because monopolistic markets, they can set the price. They don't take the advantage of the consensus of the whole in finding those prices. Now, does that mean that in that eBay auction where the price of that software went to $169, that really was the value of that software? No, because what happens in auctions is that the value, the price that is finally determined, can include more than just the price of the product. It can include a premium for the thrill of the auction. It can include the entertainment value of it. Lottery tickets are very much this way. Lotteries are, In technical terms, they are what we call unfair games. The expected payoff is well below what you pay for the ticket. However, you're not paying just to win. You're paying for the thrill of thinking you're going to win. You're paying for that stupid little 1 second thrill of scratching off the stupid ticket. So you're paying for more than just the product. Oftentimes. Have any of you ever gone to a casino? Yeah, okay. I mean, you don't go to a casino just to play. You go to a casino, just to win, I'm sorry. You go to a casino to play. And when I was in Vegas, yeah, I went there and I played at the tables, but a lot of it was just the thrill of playing at the tables, the atmosphere, the fun, the girls, all of the, you know, the booze. It wasn't just about the value of the play. It was about the value of the entire package. So keep in mind that when you're talking about auctions, auctions can discover price. Definitely. They can discover price. But sometimes auctions can discover a price that includes the value of the item plus the value of the thrill of the experience itself. There, I'll pay a little extra just to beat the ass off some troll on eBay. You know, I'll pay $10 more just to knock some idiot out who's trying to win, beat me. So keep that in mind. Auctions are a wonderful way to discover prices, but they do have the disadvantage of winner's curse in them. Sometimes. Okay, let me break down auctions into a couple of different kinds. The ones on eBay are examples of what are called English auctions. Now, an English auction is an auction where bidding starts low and goes up until a price is discovered for the seller. This is the auction that most people would be most familiar with and would describe as an auction. And these are very common. eBay, perhaps you've seen or heard about these auctions for at fancy art galleries for works of art, those kinds of things. Today at auction, we have a fabulous example of a blue nude of our friend right here. Indeed, this is a buyer's dream for any tasteful gallery. We will begin the bidding at $250,000. Do I hear $250,000? Now, in the fancy auctions, first of all, they go, yeah, I want that nude. They would be very subtle. They might be just a hand signal or a twitch or something like that. And oftentimes, the actual buyers aren't there. Their representatives, who are specialists in auctions, are there to do the bidding. And I might want that picture. I really want that picture. But I will hire you because you do this as for a living. Go to these auctions and I pay you a certain amount of money to take care of the bidding and winning for me, right? Win. Okay, we have an auction, we have a starting bid of 250. Do I hear 250? And you give maybe a little hand sign or something like this. We have 250. Do I hear 270? 270. Do we have 270? And you, sort of like this, put your finger in your nose. 270. We have 270. This fine nude is now at $270,000. Do we have 290,000? Do I have 290? And you, you give a twitch of your muscles to 290. Do we have 290? Do we have 300,000? 300,000. Do we have 300,000? And okay, and no one's moving. Okay, 290,000. Going once, 290,000. Going twice, bam! So, that gavel coming down is the formation of the contract, the acceptance of the offer of $290,000. That would be an English auction. See how the bidding starts low and rises? Okay. Now, by the way, when I as the auctioneer, if you took business law from me, you would learn that I as the auctioneer saying 290,000, do I have 290,000? That's not an offer. When he twitches, that is the offer of 290. And if I hit the gavel, that's the acceptance of it. Just keep that in mind. In contracts, it sounds kind of weird, but the offer is actually being made by him by signaling that he is agreeable to that price that I suggested. But I just suggested a price. That's how advertising works too. When an advertiser puts a price for a product in the paper, the advertiser isn't offering. You're actually offering when you go in to buy the product. It sounds weird, but it actually works that way. I'd explain it more if you took a business law course from me. But okay, that's an English auction. Very typical, very common. However, there is another kind of auction called a Dutch auction. Now, a Dutch auction is one where the bidding, where the bidding starts high and then goes down until a buyer is found. A buyer is found. Now, let me ask you. First of all, I'll tell you, Dutch auctions are very common, extraordinarily common, and in your life, you will probably do a Dutch auction for something of very large value. Can you tell me where Dutch auctions occur commonly? Bingo! Well, actually a car too. Either one of those. A house, for example, it is listed by the seller at some price. And then as time goes on, and if no one buys it, then the price will go down. In fact, I, as a buyer of a house, and once a long time ago when I bought a house, the price started, I believe, at about $215,000. And so I simply did not accept. Later, the offer came in to sell the house at a lower price, $295,000. I held off, and then eventually I suggested $191,000 and as a counteroffer, and the house was sold. But that's exactly right. The price started high and then went down until a buyer was found, in that case me. Cars are very often the same way. Recently I got a car. It's a very nice one. Don't any of you dent that damn thing out there in the parking lot. I will break you. And I started out at a much higher, very high price, which I knew was just a lead-in price. And then I looked at it, and I came back, and the used car salesman said, well, we could might be able to cut you something on this. You know, maybe we'll bring the price down $1,000. So I said, I don't think about it. Didn't call back. And a little bit later, I just went in there again just to walk around, and then the price was lower. And at that lower price, I accepted. Dutch auction. Classic Dutch auctions. You will do, actually surprisingly, a number of Dutch auctions. And interestingly enough, Dutch auctions actually... Dutch auctions can actually work to your advantage. Your danger as a buyer in a Dutch auction is worrying that as the price is going down, someone's going to grab it before you let the price settle lower. However, if you are smart about what you're doing, a Dutch auction can work to your advantage because the price can, if you hold on, you can let that price be discovered at a very low, much lower level than the initial bid. No one pays list. You've heard that before. Why don't they pay list? Because it's a damn Dutch auction. That's what car buying is. That's what house buying is. In fact, there are a lot of times on Craigslist where what you are seeing, you know, Craig, have any of you ever been on Craigslist? Do you know what it is? Craigslist rules. It is actually much, I have gotten much better deals on Craigslist than on eBay. Because on Craigslist, people just simply say, I have this for sale and here's my price. Well, you just call them up. You might go over and have a look at it, and then you offer, tell you what. I'll give you an example. Camera. The guy said, I want $250. Camera was used, but hardly ever used. Retail, it was $669 on Amazon.com. I looked at it, and I simply said, I'll pay you $100. He accepted. So there was not a chance for someone else to come in and cut me off. So I didn't suffer winner's curse, and I got it at a very good deal. Craigslist works that way quite well. So if you're not into fighting with other idiots, you might find that Craigslist is a better place, especially in a market like this where you don't have lots of people who might come over and have a look at it and try to snatch it at a higher price. Okay? So keep that in mind. Another example of Dutch auctions, have any of you ever gone to Third Sundays out here? Do you know what they are? Oh, man, you guys. In the spring, late spring through the summer and into the early fall, every third Sunday, over at the Interstate Commerce Center, where the fairgrounds is, all of these antique and flea market and used stuff dealers are over there selling their stuff at booths and tables. A lot of junk, a lot of crap, but also a lot of very cool stuff. And those are Dutch auctions because they'll have a price on it. I had a lighter, gorgeous lighter. He had a price on it, $15. I always make sure that I have a $5 bill in one pocket, a $10 bill in another pocket, and a couple of ones in another pocket. So what I did was I fished around and I pulled out the pocket I knew the five was. Look, I got $5. And he took it. Dutch auction. So that's another example of it, okay? So keep that in mind. If you go to Third Sunday, go and put different amounts of money in different pockets so that you just, well, this is all I got, like this. And you would be surprised at what you can get at a Dutch auction that way. As a matter of fact, you saw me trying to screw in my microphone here a while ago. Brand new in the box. He had a price on this of $35. And this is a gorgeous Smith & Wesson cutter knife. And I just reached into my pocket, and I found a $10 bill and a couple of ones in there. I said, this is what I got. He said, fine. Deal done. And that's Dutch auction. And it's classic price discovery. Okay? One other kind of auction I'll bring up to you, called a sealed bid auction. The sealed bid auction is also very common in big business and government. This is an auction where bidders for a contract submit their bids and they are then opened and the best is accepted. Now, there can be sealed bid auctions on the buyer side and sealed bid auctions on the seller side. Now, I'm going to give you an example of a classic one would be a government, a municipal government might want a building built. And so what the government, municipal authority would do is put out a call for bids to build the building. This is what we want. And contractors would then submit their price to do this project. And they would be blind to what others had. And then at the time, at some specified time, all of the sealed bids would be opened and they would look at them and see which one was the lowest price. And that's the one that would be the winner of the contract. That's a classic sealed bid auction. They occur for all kinds of things. In fact, I've done sealed bid auctions. Recently, I sold a domain in a sealed bid auction. I accept bids. The minimum bid is $100. And then I got not quite a dozen bids, and I just simply accepted the one that was the highest of those that had been submitted to me. That's a sealed bid auction. Now, I'll give you another example here, but I meant to bring up this term earlier in the course, and these two terms, but now I have to. Look, an agent is a represents the seller of a product or service. An agent represents the seller of a product or service. A broker represents the buyer of a good or service. So when everyone in here, I'm almost sure, all of you have an insurance agent. That means that the person or the company represents the seller of insurance products or a group of sellers of insurance products. They don't represent you. They represent the companies. A broker, on the other hand, represents the buyer. When big companies want insurance, they don't go to agents. They go to brokers who represent them and go to the insurance companies. Now, what does this have to do with sealed bid auctions? Here we go. You are a giant company, and you are deciding that you're going to have a new project, a big new factory. So you bring me in as an insurance broker. Now, in a brokerage firm, there would be a producer who is a salesman, an account executive who would take care of all the day-to-day matters when the account was formed, and then you would have underwriters and other people like that underneath there. But, okay, now you come to me, I'm the producer or slash account executive, and we say we want to insure this new property, this new factory. And I say, okay, then what I would do is I would go formulate the requirements that you would have. That would be my specialty. Figure out what the coverages would be, umbrellas, deductibles, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. And then I would go to insurance companies representing you and say, here's the insurance this company needs. Here's the insurance this company needs. Here's the insurance this company needs. And then I would let you work out what it would be that you would charge as the premium for this insurance policy. That's a sealed bid auction. Because I would take the lowest bid. I would take the lowest of the bids. Now, you, if you were smart, you might go to another insurance broker to see what he could do for you as well. So if I don't want him crossing me in the market, I will lock these people in, these insurance companies in, so that if he hits them, they'll just say, I'm already bidding for someone else. And what I would do is try to lock up as much of the market as possible to choke you off so your game wasn't going to work with me. Okay? You wouldn't know that was happening. Okay, but I would try to lock the markets. So the only place that you would be submitting sealed bids is to me. So that would be a sealed bid auction because I would take the lowest price for the best coverage. There might be some of that in there too. So you might offer me different things. And then I would say, this is my best. On the other hand, interestingly though, in the real world, and some of you might get into this kind of insurance. It's actually different from, you know, auto insurance. State Barn is there and all that kind of. This is more high powered. This can get into some serious international stuff, fun stuff. I know people in this business. They really love it. And you can make huge money if you are good at what you do. Or you can make minimal money if you're not good at what you do. But here's one of the things that can happen, okay? In this process, I've gone to different insurance companies. I've submitted what I need. Their underwriters are busting their asses trying to figure out what to do, how to price it. You might call me on the phone. Hey, you know, look. Give me a hint. What are these other guys pricing? Now, if I'm, of course, perfectly ethical, I'll say, can't do it, that's not how it works, that's not ethical, as a matter of fact, it's not legal, I can't tell you anything. And you could say, oh, come on, man, where do I start here on this? Nope. Look, you remember last Christmas with the 2 bottles of wine? This Christmas, 5 bottles of wine, a couple of steaks, you know, maybe a party with some girls, you know, nope. How many girls? Yeah. And, well, it doesn't work. It's not bribing, but there is a lot of, oh boy, you know, slap on the back. The presents come, lots of, you know, you're going to send me presents at Christmas to make sure that I know you're around and all that. But look, I'm not going to tell you what anyone else is bidding. But if I were to tell you what anyone else is bidding, I'd say you might not really be in the ball game above $210,000. Now, I've done something that's not right. And at first blush, it is going to defeat the price discovery process. Especially because the truth of the matter is the best bid I've seen so far is $250,000 for the premium. But I told you $210,000. Well, of course, you go back. Yeah, uh-huh. And you submitted $205,000. Best bid, you win. Now, of course, this is not ethical, and it's not legal. But it certainly is part of the price discovery process. Why? Because in reality, the best bid I got before yours was $250,000. You could not have offered me $205,000 unless that really was something you could afford to offer me. So all I did was force the market to get real and squeeze out some of that profit that they had padded into their premiums. If you can offer me $205,000, you're going to be okay with doing it. If you could not have, you would have said, oh, FTF, are you nuts? I was working this out, the best I could do was 247. No! What the heck? But if you really could do 205,000 to me, all I've done is helped you find Jesus. Do you see how it works? So even though what I've just described to you would be unethical, would be illegal, at the same time, it does not defeat the discovery of a fair market price. Because she could not have offered me $205,000 unless her company could really have afforded to offer me $205,000. Unless she's crazy. But do you see the idea there? So sometimes sealed bid auctions can be a little bit less than sealed bid. There can be leaks in the auctions, but the leaks do not necessarily defeat the price discovery process of the auction. It's just a little bit of a cautionary tale to you about these things. Now, I'm going to take this off the board, and I'm going to go on to the next subject, which was the first thing I mentioned in the introduction. I want you to think about it like this. I'm going to do forward contracts now. Now, just as a loose, quick, dirty definition, a forward contract is an agreement that guarantees one or more particulars. Forward contract is an agreement that guarantees one or more particulars. I'll give you a is a quick example. When I did oil and gas in Texas, we had a little wildcat operation out in the patch, and there was a truck that would come and on a regular basis and pick up the oil from our tanks. And we could do it two different ways. When the truck came, we could take spot for our oil. In other words, what the prevailing price was for the day on oil. Or we could have an agreement that we would take the same a guaranteed price for every pickup for 6 months. That's a forward contract. Because it guaranteed that as much as we want to sell, we get a specific price for it. So if prices of oil fell, we would do really well. But of course, if prices of oil went up, you know, that would kind of suck on us. You know, if spot was 25 and our forward was at 23, we lost some money. But of course, if spot was 20 and our forward was 23, we would get something. But what it did was it took out the uncertainty from our dealings. And it was just a matter of how much risk did we want to ride the ups and downs of the market? Did we want to bet on an upside movement of oil? Or did we want to just get our guarantee and not sweat it? Think about it this way. Madam, I'm going to offer you a contract. For the rest of your life, you will get gasoline at $4 a gallon. For the rest of your life, no matter how much you want, anywhere in the country. Now, do you see that that's really twisted? Because right now, gasoline prices are low. $1.79, $1.75, a couple places. But you've seen gas prices go, they didn't go up, they went stupid. And you might have even heard the doomsayers, $8 a gallon, $10 a gallon, that's what it's going to be, peak oil. So you know there's a risk of steep upside movement. But you also know that it might not go that high, possibly. So do you see that this is kind of a mixed bag for you? In the sense that it gives you a sense of certainty. It removes a risk. You don't have to worry about that in your budget anymore in the sense of not knowing what it's going to do to your budget. You know for the rest of your life what it's going to do to your budget. So you see how forward contracts, if she goes to the gas station, she'll pay spot if she doesn't do this with me. She'll just pay spot. And that's the word you use. You call it spot. But if she does it, well, she's got a guarantee. It might burn like hell now. It might even burn like hell for a long, long time if gas prices don't go up. But it might benefit her. More importantly, though, it takes out uncertainty. Some people are more willing to take the risk than other people are. Some people, I'll ride spot. But other people, no, I won't. Anyway, yeah, go ahead.
Couldn't you get one of those contracts, like the $4 per gallon, and then just keep the contract and then go buy it for regular price, and then if it ever goes past that?
Yes, you could. Brilliant. Of course, if I'm going to offer the contract, I'm not going to be stupid enough not to put in the price with the certain knowledge that that's just what she'll do. You see? Because if I'm a gas company, what I know is that if the price is below the forward contract value, if the spot is below it, she's going to go with spot. So what I do is I price the contract in such a way that I make up the difference that she's going to gain by riding spot when spot's below the forward value. Sure. No question about it. And that's why I'll price the contract to make sure that I still make my money off that side of it. And I've got to let her have the downside that easily. Sorry. And that's the way it'll work in any market, too. I'm sorry about that. But the thing of it is, though, that you will live in a world of forward contracts. When you get your first job, you're going to be given real career out of college. You might even be there now. They're going to have a salary for you. They're not going to move your salary every day with the spot market for labor of your kind. They're going to give you a guarantee or a P period of, say, a year or whatever your review to your next pay grade, review is. So clearly, you're going to be in a world of spot market, of forward contracts, your whole life to one extent or another. In fact, interestingly enough, out here, and this is true in a number of states, have you seen that thing where you can buy college credits for your kid? You can actually buy them, and then when the kid gets to college age, the credit has been, he's got a certain number of credits you've already bought for him. And regardless of what the price of college tuition is at the time the kid goes to college, this is a guarantee. He gets the credits. He buys that many credits. He doesn't pay money. He just pays with these vouchers. And in that way, do you see how those are a classic forward contract? You're paying a certain amount of money now that the state just puts in the bank and makes money off from. But when you want to go to college, regardless of what college tuition costs are, you got your college tuition for at least that number of credits. And some parents think this is a wonderful idea because they can just start young and just keep buying credits every year until the kid graduates from high school and pretty much have the kid's education paid for. Of course, there's a downside to that. Well, on one downside is, of course, that college tuitions could collapse, like that's never going to happen. The other downside is the kid could turn out to be, you know, a total dumbass, loser, burnout, goth emo, and not want to go to college. And, you know, I paid all this money, and the kid says, screw you, I'm going to join a biker gang, you know. So, you know, you see there is a risk in it, but that's one forward contract. Yeah, go ahead. There are transferability is in some states, yes, in some states, no. That's an interesting thing, though, because there is the possibility that you could sell them to someone else, unless there's a covenant in the forward contract against that. And in some cases, there are covenants against that. But let me show you how powerful forward contracts can be. When I talk about, and I will not get into options in this class, but options are a standardized contract, forward contract. The classic example of a very standardized forward contract is what is called a futures contract. And a futures market is the market in which futures contracts are sold. When I talk about forward contracts in general, they're freewheeling. It's whatever the we're talking about, the how much you buy, how much you sell could be determined at the time of the sale. Different parts of it could be open to negotiation. Futures contracts are really standardized. There's a fixed amount at a fixed time that's going to be bought or sold. All that kind of stuff is set in stone so that there is no question about any part of the contract other than what the contract is for. So if I'm going to buy contracts on pork bellies, I know exactly, a futures contract on pork bellies, I know exactly how many pork bellies are going to be delivered. I know exactly all of the provisions of the contract. And that's why they are very popular, as they're a standardized kind of instrument. Now, let me first of all disabuse, there's an old myth that if you buy futures contracts on pork bellies and you don't pay attention, you could have 100,000 pork bellies show up on your doorstep. That's not true. They don't work that way. The contract's clear. They're just pure financial instruments. But what I want to do is get it clear that futures contracts are essential instruments of business, of big business, and even of some small businesses, as a risk management tool. Suppose that you own a trucking company. Who looks like a truck? You look like a trucker man, okay? Truck driving company. You've got all of your trucks. You've made sure that you've gotten drivers for all of those trucks. You know, you make sure that the guys, when they sit at the bar, they're a crack show, and you know, they've all got their 8-track tapes that play C.W. McCall's Convoy, and all of that. You've got a trucking company. You are in the business of trucking, of moving merchandise from one place to another over the roads. Trucks, truck tires, merchandise, tolls, all of that stuff. That's your business. Trucking. You're a trucking man. 10-4. But you have to buy gasoline for your trucks. Distillate like diesel, but we'll say they're gasoline trucks. You have to buy gasoline for your trucks. Gasoline, if it goes up in price, your profit goes down. If it goes down in price, your profit goes up, right? But you're not in the business of gasoline, man. You're a trucking man. You do not have a business in gasoline. It's just something that is used in your trucks. So you should not be losing money or making money because of gasoline prices. That's not your business. And you're thinking to yourself, well, isn't it part of the business? No. No. Look, you are in the trucking business. When gas prices go up, your profits fall. When gas prices go down, your profit rises. In other words, you are bearing profit volatility, which is risk, because of something that is not your core business. That's not how business should work. You should not be torn up and down because of gas prices. Sure, you're going to celebrate your profits better when the gas prices have dropped, but then you're going to be crying when the price of gasoline goes up. You shouldn't be celebrating or crying, either one, because of the gas prices. I've got to emphasize that. You don't have to. And you should not. If there's a way to move a risk away from you, you should do it, as long as the price is proper. In this world of business, in economics, have you ever heard they saying there's someone for everyone? Well, I've met a few guys, that's not true. There's no one for them. They're so damned ugly. But in general, and I wasn't looking at anyone in particular here, for God's sake. Yeah. But in general, there is someone for everyone. You see, in the world of business, there is a market for anything. Whatever you want, there's a way. And that was something that I learned of all the bizarre lessons I learned when I was in the crazy end of consulting. In the end of it, it's Pulp Fiction without the fun. Well, there was fun. I found out there really is a market. You want anything, it's there. You want gold, you want girls, you want drugs, you want excitement, you want adventure, you want a plane, you want a boat, you want whatever you want, it's there. There's sellers and there's buyers for everything. And I mean everything in the world. In that world where there are entrepreneurs everywhere, there are entrepreneurs who want risk. They will take risk for you. They will bear risk. You can pay them to take risk. In fact, sometimes they'll even buy risk from you because that's their business. They will do the hard work. There are mercenaries who will take care of going down and extracting a hostage. You want the hostage. You don't want the risk. You pay them. They'll take the risk of going and getting that. There are people, you can pay them to go and buy the drugs. They'll take the risk. That's what their business is. Their business isn't the drugs. Their business is the risk. Many drug dealers are actually that way. They don't do their drugs. They're not stupid. They are there for the risk, to take it off the street users to buy the large quantities. That's how the world works. There are buyers of risk. There are people who will be paid to take risks. That's what futures markets are about. That's what forward contracts are about. They are about moving risk away from one person or one entity that does not want that risk and onto another who wants it. Because risk is money. Risk really is money. But there's a downside to risk because risk can, like, kick your ass. And some people just, yeah, there's money in it, but I don't want that. In your trucking business, look, you can make money if gas prices go down. You don't want that risk. You're not a gasoline speculator. You're a trucker. That's why these futures contracts can exist. Look, in this market, you could go into that market and buy futures contracts for gasoline. Now, what will happen if gas prices go up? What will happen, without even knowing how futures contracts work, what will happen to you? What will happen to you if gas prices go up? What will happen to your futures contracts? They'll go up. You'll make money. You'll make buttloads of money. Gas prices go up, your contract rises in value. You make money that day. Futures are weird. They renew every day. It's kind of weird. But if gas prices go down, your contract will fall in value. You'll lose money on the contract. But look what's happening in the bigger picture. When gas prices go up, you lose profit in your trucking business, but that is compensated by the money you've made in the taking the opposite position in the futures market. So it levels. And on the other side, if gas prices go down, you make more profit on your trucking operation, but you've lost money on the futures contract position. So again, your profit is level. You have hedged away the risk of gasoline prices, and you have moved that risk to the seller of a futures contract who is willing to take that risk. And all that's left is a steady stream of profit that represents the profit of being a trucking company, not a trucking company / gasoline speculator. That's what we call hedging. Farmers do this too. A farmer can actually move into a grain market and sell futures contracts. So when prices go down, he makes money. When prices go up, he loses money. And so that offsets the volatility in his grain operations so that it levels out his cash flow and takes away risk and therefore makes him more certain. And he then is no longer a farmer who would be in this, using hedges like this, would no longer be in the ups and downs of the global grain markets and all the weird-ass things that can happen when self-promoting idiots talk about using corn for ethanol, and then all that falls apart and the corn prices collapse back through the floor again. All of that goes away. And he is a grain farmer, and he's making a steady stream, not on the volatility of the corn, but on the fact that he actually grows corn. I give you this cautionary tale because there was a big thing back when gasoline prices were just going up, oil was getting stupidly expensive per barrel. There were these self-promoting congressmen and a lot of leftist bloggers who were talking about, well, we've got to end the speculation in these futures markets. That's what's caused the price to go up, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's greed. And of course, when the prices went back down, they're all shut the pie holes now. They kept talking about these speculators, these evil people. They're wrong. Those speculators are crucial to the price discovery process in those futures markets. They have to be there because that's what creates the density of bids for contracts, of offers to sell, offers to buy. That's crucial to the price discovery process. You'll read about that in the article. I explain that price discovery and how speculators, well, they're not doing their, all they care about is making a profit. Well, duh, yeah, that's the whole idea. They are bearing risk and they're being paid. They're making their money by bearing the risk, taking it off the shoulders of the companies that actually use hydrocarbon products. That's the whole reason they're there. And that's why you cannot kill greed, because greed is going to motivate them to move the prices to fair market values. And then those represent the values that the businesses can use in their hedging positions. Keep that in mind. Sometimes the evilest people in the world, and speculators can be grim, greasy, evil, greedy people, can actually be crucial, essential to the efficiency of a market. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.